Hello and welcome to andallthat.co.uk's Meet the Historians, the programme where we try and get behind the history books to find out what motivates the historians who write them. In the current series, we've been focusing on the history of the Soviet Union from 1941 until its collapse in 1991. The period of Soviet history between Nikita Khrushchev's fall from power in 1964 and the arrival of Mikhail Gorbachev as premier in 1985 has often been seen as a period of economic, social and political stagnation in the USSR. For the vast majority of this 20-year time frame, the USSR was governed by one man, Leonid Brezhnev. As such, the Brezhnev era has earned a reputation for being a flatline in the development of a socialist experiment. However, this view is far from universal. To discuss the nature of Brezhnev's rule in Russia, and particularly the extent to which it might be considered as a period of stagnation, I'm joined today on the line from Bern University by John Keep, the Emeritus Professor of Russian History at the University of Toronto. Professor Keep has written a wide range of books on the history of Russia and the Soviet Union, covering the rise of social democracy in Russia to the revolutions of 1917 and a long-term study of the Tsarist armies from the Middle Ages to the 19th century. Since retiring in 1988, he's co-written a retrospective on Stalinism and has also produced a fantastic overview of the Soviet period in his A History of the Soviet Union, 1945 to 1991, The Last of the Empires, which is recommended core reading for the study of the USSR. Professor Keep, thank you for joining us and welcome to the programme.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I talked in the introduction just about a little bit about Brezhnev's rule and being dubbed this period of stagnation, notably by people like Gorbachev. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about why it's got that title, this period of stagnation.
Well, I don't accept that title, actually. I don't think it was a time of stagnation. It was a time of conservatism. What Brezhnev wanted was to keep things stable. He was very much a man of the cadres, you know. He believed in the stability of cadres. Once you were appointed, there you stayed, and you pretended to work, and he pretended to pay you. That's roughly how it was. And he didn't want any shake-up. And so he kept the ideology. I do think that's still very important when one's looking at the Soviet Union at any period to realize that they were into building a new society on socialist principles and that the people in charge, most of them, took that pretty seriously. But then the cynics will tell you, well, they were only in it in order to maintain their own positions, their status and so on, which is perfectly true. They often had a hand in it. They were not always quite loyal or incorrupt and so on. But nevertheless, I do think that it mattered to them, and they believed that the system was better than ours and that it was destined to win the world, so to say, and that they therefore should try and do their best to keep it going. So it was a time of conservatism, but Gorbachev, of course, said it was stagnation, and he has a point, because what was going on was that they were keeping up all these old-fashioned industries which were not really productive, not efficient any longer. Steel and coal and iron, they were the main basis of the economy. And in fact, we were moving, the world was moving on into what they call nowadays a knowledge economy rather than an industrial economy. But the Soviets, being conservative, they thought, well, we've built all this and it got us through World War II. It's fine. This is the way to the future. More and more industry. They didn't care a hoot about ecology. They were ruining the environment, but never mind. They went on building and they went on emitting all these polluting substances, right? And their production did not rise as well as far as they thought it would, but still it was working. So that when Gorbachev said it's stagnating, well, he had a point, because they were ignoring the future and keeping on in the old-fashioned way.
Do you think that was down to Brezhnev's choices, or was that, if you're saying it's a period of conservatism, was that Marxism-Leninism that led them down this line rather than Brezhnev himself?
Good point. Well, I think it was both. Brezhnev, as I say, was a man from the apparatus, and he was not a man of great original ideas, in distinction from Khrushchev, who certainly had his own point of view and pushed his own policies very forcibly. But then they got tired of Khrushchev and they booted him out and they put in somebody who was safe, whom they thought would do what the others were doing and keep them all quiet and happy. And for the first few years, Brezhnev ruled quite well. But then he got sick already in 1968. And then later on, he was really a dead man, you know. And they kept him in office, although the people close to him realized that he was no longer able to take decisions, but they pretended as though he was still functioning. And that was a grave weakness because they were all getting on in years. And the others, like Andropov, who had his wits about him and who knew what was to be done up to a point, he thought, well, if I kick him out and bury him and take over, then I'll have to carry the responsibility and they'll all hate me. And he didn't want to do that. And the same went for the others. They all just went on pretending as though things were moving normally towards progress, towards communism and all the rest of it, although they were beginning to doubt whether that was really true.
Almost he becomes the front for them to carry on ruling in their own
way
in the background.
Yes, he's a sort of front man, that's right, yes. And, I mean, the doctors knew how sick he was, but only the other politicians could turf him out. And if they didn't want to do it, well, he stayed. And he was a rather vain man in his later years. He liked to collect medals and rewards of various sorts and stick them on his chest. And he liked parades and he liked all these the ceremonials and so on that you had in Soviet times. And anniversaries were always celebrated. I mean, 1970, it was 100 years since Lenin's birth. And then you had the anniversary of the foundation of the Soviet Union, 50 years of that in 1972. And so it went on. And Brezhnev enjoyed himself, you see. He liked receiving visitors. But I will say this for him. He had been through World War II. He had fought. And so far as we know, he had fought quite well. He was a senior officer. And he didn't want to go through war again. And he was very much, you might say, a peacenik. He wanted détente. He wanted a relaxation of tension with the West. And although at the same time he was building up the Soviet missile system, the Soviet armaments were increasing, he was rearming the country, but somehow he thought that he could get away with that and that they had now achieved a kind of balance with the United States and that therefore they could work out some kind of compromise, which indeed they did, you see. You had in 1975, you had Helsinki, you had the agreements there, and the Russians thought, well, they have now acknowledged our strength and power in Eastern Europe. And in return, so what, we can say, yes, we will observe civil rights and human rights and so on. But that's all right. That's just for paper. That's for the record. We won't really bother about them much. But you see, it didn't work that way.
No, I was interested in that because, of course, in 1968, we have the whole Prague Spring, the Czech uprising. Yes. And was this a mistake then on his part or did he not think the West would be quite so outraged at what happened there?
Well, he got away with that in the way because I think he waited. He hesitated a long time before he ordered the Warsaw Pact troops to invade Czechoslovakia. He didn't want to do it because he realized that there was something behind the Prague Spring movement. It was a kind of return to neo-Leninist ideas and there was something valuable in it. And anyway, he didn't want to use force, but he had to because there was no other way he could cope. Otherwise, the movement would have spread to the other East European countries and to the Soviet Union itself. So for security reasons, he had to strike. But he didn't do it voluntarily, didn't do it with enthusiasm.
So is there any evidence then that we have an economic improvement under Brezhnev?
Oh, I think that certainly there was a switch away from the producer goods towards consumer goods, which is the way they looked at it. In other words, more effort was going into satisfying the needs of consumers. There was a good push in housing, for example. They built all these suburbs around the big cities with these monstrous blocks of flats and so on. So people did feel that there was an improvement happening, but it was going terribly slowly. And also the production of food increased. They managed to do something about agriculture. It wasn't very effective, but they were certainly getting on. And of course, they imported a lot of food from the West, from the United States, Argentina, and so on. and there was a way of keeping people happy. The prices were reasonably low. Most people could get by somehow. So I think certainly I agree with you, there was a shift. There was a shift to better living under Brezhnev. And that's why today a lot of people look back on this era as a sort of golden era, the time of prosperity and peace, stability, which they haven't had since 1989.
But how much of that do you think was dependent on, say, the black market and the shadow market providing for people?
Oh, yes. Well, a lot of it was due to the black market, that's right. And the authorities knew what was going on, but they didn't want to, they couldn't actually stop it. They held their hands in the pie, really, and because in order to get by, you had to be able to obtain goods, not just from the state shops, but also from private dealers and so on. That was true of the towns, less so of the villages, I think. But certainly there were these underground networks which had their links with the people in power. There was a kind of underground economy, as you say, and even an underground society. You could say a lot of people were living almost without taking any notice of what the authorities were saying. Society was going on, life was going on. And so they thought that the authorities disapproved. They tried to marshal people into movements and organizations and so on. They had to turn up on parades and say the right thing. And of course, there was no freedom in our sense of the word at all. But it was a way of living, which people accepted because in general, they were rather submissive. And that's true of the Russians. I wouldn't say it's true of all the other peoples in the Soviet Union who had a different tradition than the Russians had.
So does that go back a bit further? So that's not something that's inculcated by the Communist Party, that's something that you're saying is a deeper trend in Russian
society. Well,
it's
a controversial question, but I think there is something to the idea of national character because it is formed by social and political environments, and it goes right back 1,000 years, you might say. I mean, the Russians have never had a very strong sense of law. They have not had the sense that we have had in the West, especially in the UK, that the people have something to say in government, and that it's a good thing to maintain civilized standards and to respect other people's rights and duties and to observe the law. They haven't had that, you see, because the law has always been on the service of the people in power and it's been manipulated in their interests. And therefore, they don't trust law as something above the rest of us, something that you have to take seriously. They think it's just something that you can manipulate.
It's possibly something that we see then in the Russian situation today with Putin and the oligarchs and things like this.
Yes, and things got worse in the Soviet era because indeed the law was then the servant of the party, and that attitude has tended to survive because the 10 years under Yeltsin were really pretty disastrous for most people. They suffered a lot and they tended to blame the Yeltsin government for their predicament. And to blame the West because it was, if you like, a pro-Western government at that time in the 1990s. And Putin was then regarded as a savior when he came into power in 2000 and started tightening things up and making life more convenient, as it seemed, for people, more comfortable. And he was welcomed. Now I think they've got a second thoughts coming about that. Because Putin is becoming a bit of a despot in the old traditional style. Not something like Stalin, but certainly a strong ruler who wants to get his own ideas implemented.
So you talked a little bit a moment ago about the party having to almost mobilise people into organisations and participation. Do you think that is a big change then? Because I know under Stalin there's a lot of evidence that people were actually believed they were building a new society, were quite willing to get involved with things.
Yes.
So is there maybe an element of apathy, stagnation in people's attitudes towards the Soviet Union?
Well, I think under Stalin you had outright terror. Nobody knew whether he would live to the morrow because people who were totally innocent and totally loyal were being arrested at dead of night and sent off to the Gulag or even shot. After all, in 1937, 38, in the Great Terror, he killed over 750,000 people in a few months. So you see, that was a very different kind of world to what we have in the 1960s and 1970s, because Khrushchev had dissociated the regime, so far as he could, from the terrorist methods of Stalin, not completely. You still had security establishment, which could lock people up if they really wanted to, but they weren't being arrested en masse and sent off to their deaths, you see. So in that sense, you have a different situation, and people felt freer, they felt more secure, and they felt they could do things that they wanted to do without having to bother too much about what the bosses told them to do.
So we get, obviously, quite a, well, not a big growth, but certainly a growth of dissident activity and opposition to the regime under Brezhnev's rule. Is that then more of a sign that they are freer to be dissidents than it is about criticism? Or is there weight behind this dissident movement as well?
Well, I think the dissident movement was really very small. We tended to concentrate a lot of attention on it because of our hopes that it would lead to a change, which in a sense it did. There were only a few thousand dissidents, shall we say 10,000 on the whole, and they were mostly intellectuals. They were not very strongly based in the populace as such. But all the same, it was a sign that all was not well, that things were not going the way that the party leaders wanted them to go, that they didn't believe in these sentiments. And in fact, many of the people in authority didn't really believe that you were proceeding in a measured pace from socialism to communism and all that stuff. They were thinking of their own interests. So there was a kind of undercurrent of disbelief, a kind of switching off from what the propagandists were saying. People didn't bother much about them. I mean, the papers were full of propaganda, but you didn't read them. You went to the end of the paper and there was the football results and you went and looked at them. So that's not really dissidence, but it's a kind of switching off, I would say.
So how significant do you think they were in the end? Because, of course, people like Sakharov go on to be part of the new Russia, the post-Soviet Russia as well. Were they a significant movement? Were they?
Well, I think they were very significant because they represented the conscience of Russia. They were intellectuals in the main, as I said, and they were people who remembered or who knew about the traditions of the country. Some of them were rather nationalistic, it's true. Some of them looked rather to the West. They had their own ideas. And in the way, they relished the fight that they conducted with the people in power, with the secret police. And they would meet in their own kitchens, in their flats, and talk freely, because you didn't have bugs everywhere. Possibly you could talk quite freely in certain places, or certainly out in the open air. And so it was an exciting time for them, because they were standing up for values that we consider, most of us, to be very important. Some of them were religious, some of them were secular. And of course, if they were not Russian, if they were, say, Ukrainians or Armenians or Georgians, then they have a national flavour to their sentiments too.
So was there much unity in the movement then, or was it very disunified between?
No, not really, no. They tried to form kind of sort of cooperative committees and that kind of thing, but they didn't really flourish because the police were watching it all the time. And any effort to coordinate activities was likely to incur repression. So that really what you have are groups of people who shared common ideas. For instance, religious ideas. Some of them were, we might say, Protestants rather than Orthodox or sectarians. And they would come together on the common ground and try to stand up for their own beliefs and to push their beliefs and spread their views through illicit literature, often duplicating materials and passing them around.
How important, then, do you think that sort of samizdat, that self-publishing was for the movement?
Oh, I think it was very important, really. But I wouldn't say that samizdat brought the regime down. It didn't. What you had were groups of people who held different points of view from those in authority and who were quite bravely, in some cases, even suicidally, going ahead and standing up for these ideas. Therefore, it was certainly a vague, important movement. But it wasn't a mass movement, and it didn't bring the regime down. What brought the regime down was the regime itself, which is most extraordinary, really. Nobody expected it to happen. But then you had Gorbachev, and everything started to shift. And once the authorities had lost control, then some of the old dissidents came out and became and occupied leading positions in the popular movements.
Do you think Gorbachev was left in an impossible position with the legacy that Brezhnev left him? Or is Gorbachev reasonably responsible for the breakup of the Union?
Well, I think everybody has to bear responsibility for their actions, and that includes Gorbachev. But one must say that he was an idealist who struggled very hard against the old conservative people in the apparatus to put forward reformist ideas, which he thought would lead to a resurgence of what he would call socialism, that is, Leninism. Back to Lenin was his slogan, really. But he didn't realize that by pursuing that line, he was undercutting the whole basis of the movement, the basis of communist rule. And so the more measures he took as he moved away from communism towards socialism or social democracy and even liberalism, the more isolated he became, and eventually the whole thing collapsed.
Mm. It's interesting, this idea that they view themselves all the time as going back to the ideals of Leninism, whereas Lenin, of course, believed in the guiding role of the party and really not very much in terms of democracy at all. Do you think...
Well, I think Gorbachev got his main ideas when he was a student in the 50s and 60s. He had a rather liberal upbringing, and although he was in the party apparatus, and indeed very important, he was in the Central Committee still as a very young man, he represented the generation of the 1960s. These were reformists who had been encouraged by Khrushchev, who were sorry that Khrushchev had been thrown out, who regarded the present regime as backward, as stagnant, and who wanted to change. And when he came to power and he put these ideas forward, most of the people in authority tended to go along with that. They wanted to go back to Lenin, if you like. They wanted a freer society, and they wanted, of course, an end to the Cold War too. But you see, when you talk about Lenin, you're quite right. Lenin stood for the party, leading the people, controlling the people. But there was also another Lenin behind him. There was the Lenin in his last years when he got a bit tired of all this and started to think, well, maybe we made some mistakes. Perhaps taking power in 1917 was not such a good idea. He never said that quite, but he hinted at it around 1922 when he was getting very sick. And if you look at his last works, you find all kinds of hints that a more, we would say perhaps democratic or more cooperative approach, a less of a dictatorial approach, was better. What's what socialism meant to him? He talked about cooperation, you see. So if you selectively read Lenin, you can find things in him which could encourage you to think that there was a place for reformist communism distinct from Stalinism.
So just we'll finish off then on just on Brezhnev himself. Other than Stalin, nobody else has such a long impact on the Soviet Union. How do you think he is as significant as Stalin in that sense?
I think Stalin's rule was far more significant than Brezhnev's. Brezhnev was a continuer, you might say. Stalin introduced something new, or if you like, something very old, something quite archaic, a real totalitarian rule. That's what you had under Stalin, certainly. But then when that broke apart in the 1950s, and there was a bit of disorder, Khrushchev ruled for, what, 8 years or so, a bit more? Brezhnev had 18 years in power, as you say, that's quite a long time. But you see, the last years, it was not so much Brezhnev personally as it was the rule of the old guard, the old men who had worked their way up into leadership positions in the Communist Party and state apparatus and in the military, who wanted to keep things ticking over and to maintain their power. And this was this kind of, that's what you mean, I think, by stagnation. You have a group of people whose self-interest it is to continue pontificating about the ideology, like Suslov did, or introducing troops into Afghanistan, for instance, is what another thing they did, which was a very stupid thing to do. You had Ustinov, and you had Chernenko, and these Tikhonov, and these characters. They were the ones who were really dictating, not Brezhnev personally, because he couldn't. He was just the front man, as you said.
Mm. So that's quite interesting in itself, is it not, that we have this kind of collective rule under Brezhnev, without we're not being an official collective rule, but certainly more so than any other Soviet leaders we've really seen.
Because although Brezhnev cultivated his personality, so to say, in other words, there was a great cult about his so-called victorious activities in World War II, and that he was almost a genius. He encouraged that himself, which was a very stupid thing to do, because he wasn't anything of the same such type. But that was the way these regimes function. I mean, look at North Korea now, look at Kim Jong-il, Kim Jong-un. I mean, you know, it doesn't stand up to a critical glance at all. But there is a tendency in these regimes to focus on the number one. And so you're right that there was a period under Brezhnev when really you had collective rule, although they didn't acknowledge it as such. But you see that the system should have been run collectively all the time. It was just individual leaders who occasionally acquired supreme power and who used that in order to bolster their own personality, their own record, and their own achievements. But that was rather the exception. The rule was collective leadership, and that's what you had in the late 70s and 80s.
Right. I thought we might move on then just to talk about your approach to Soviet history, because I know that goes back. I was wondering really what got you interested first of all in writing about Soviet history and how you came to it in the first place.
Well, I'm not really an expert on Soviet history, you know. I got interested in Russia because of World War II. I was a young lad, and in 1941, the Soviets were fighting the Nazis, so were we, and we had an alliance. And I thought, well, it's very interesting because we had rather neglected Russian affairs previously. I'll take this up. You know, I decided to specialize in Russian history when I went to the university. But we did the whole of Russian history, you know, we had the medieval and the modern period and all the rest of it. It wasn't so much Soviet history because it wasn't regarded very as very scientific, as very professional to do Soviet history. We rather stopped around 1917. But certainly it had its interest for us, and we were watching what was going on, the students, what was going on in Russia, trying to understand what was happening. So that was how I got into Soviets, or into Russian history anyway.
So it must have been interesting to watch the whole thing unfold as you were sort of growing an interest with it.
Yeah, it was a succession of surprises. I mean, not that we perhaps appreciated sufficiently the totalitarian tendencies in Soviet society, because we were all rather sympathetic. In our group, I think we were all pretty communist, actually, or left-wing socialists at the time. And there was one man who was not. He was a conservative, and we used to mock him because we were all on the left, you see. But apart from that, we tried to understand and to sympathize and to hope that there would be better relations between the Western world and the Soviets. We underestimated the difficulties, clearly, and the time that it would take. But in a way, we weren't wrong, because Stalin was a mortal human being, and he died. And after that, things changed. It was very much a one-man show with Stalinism. And so when things changed and improved in the 1950s, there was a succession of great surprises. 1956, 20th Party Congress. Who would have thought that the Communist Party General Secretary would get up and denounce his predecessor as a tyrant? I mean, it's incredible. And I think a lot of Soviet history depended on that one speech in February 1956 by Khrushchev, because after that it knocked the bottom out of the whole ideology, which was based on the assumption that Stalin was a genius and a hero who had led his people to victory in World War II and had built socialism and all the rest of it. And suddenly there was another Stalin, the Stalin of the Gulag, a Stalin of repression who had killed millions of people. And so people in Russia had suddenly to try to take account of that and to come to terms with it. And they've never managed to do it really yet, not yet.
Did that have a big impact on either your historical writing or the writing of other people around you, because of course very little came out of the Soviet Union, so did this knowledge of Stalin's regime change that left-wing leaning in British history? Because I know that if you look at the States, it's very conservative right-wing leaning. If we look at certain historians there who very anti the Soviet regime, I was wondering how much influence that had.
Well, I think that the more one got to know about the Soviet Russia, the more one's illusions disappeared in a way, and one realized that one was dealing with a pretty formidable enemy. And you had the Cold War, and there was a lot of antipathy to Russia, antagonism to Soviet Union, and in a sense that must have affected a little bit how one looked upon one's work. But one tries to be objective, one tries to see the other man's point of view, try to understand why it is that the for instance, why does Putin suddenly possibly go into Donetsk, yeah, and start something very serious? Perhaps he won't. But I mean, the system, the situation is changing so rapidly, we have to be aware of the other person's interests and try to take account of them when we're dealing with these countries.
So your book, Last of the Empires, was written, presumably, all post-Glasnost, was it?
Oh, yes, it was 1993, 1994, yes.
So I was just wondering how much impact events like Glasnost had on your ability to, or did they change your opinion on Soviet history significantly, or open up new avenues of inquiry?
Not really. No, I think that a lot of work had been done over the previous quarter century, very serious work, particularly by economists, for instance, on the way the Soviet Union functioned. And one was lucky enough to be able to use these writings and to incorporate them in that book, which in a way is not so much mine as a collective effort, you might say, the work of the whole academic community. So-called Sovietologists, it's not a term I very much care for. But anyway, there was serious writing. Some of it was politically biased in both directions, but a lot of it was perfectly sound scholarship. So one tried to base one's book, one's thinking, on the works of one's friends and colleagues, and to present a view which was so-called scientific, or I don't like the word scientific much either, but anyway, respectable.
Absolutely. Talk of labels, actually, just had Sovietologists there. A lot of, particularly A-level history, revolves around these themes of schools of Soviet history, you know, the Western school, the revisionist school. I was wondering what your thoughts were on labelling historians in that way, and if you would put yourself in any of those categories, or...
Well, I'm a bit too old to be in any group. Let's say I'm a traditionalist. I like to think that in history we're studying human beings and how they interrelate. You may have human beings in charge and others who obey what they do. We want to work out how these political orders function. How do these societies work? Well, you have several schools. You have the social history school. You have Sheila Fitzpatrick and her cohort, who have made an enormous contribution to understanding the way society functions independent of the regime. But Sheila would be the first to acknowledge that you can't really understand Soviet society unless you take the regime into account. You may not think that that's the most important thing that you should study, but you have to be aware that these people were, up to a cent, being moulded and shifted in a certain direction towards the goals of the people in power. And then you have the postmodernists who have come up in the 1970s and especially 1980s, who look at it rather in terms of culture, or let's say the anthropology. That also has had an enormous effect. But I would think that the risk there is that if you study only the search for identity and these things, that you tend to lose touch with what was really happening. In other words, there was a regime in which some people gave orders and others obeyed them or disobeyed them. So we need to know about how the political system was functioning, and therefore, and how people should bear the responsibility for their actions. For instance, if they were secret policemen and they killed a lot of people, they should be held to account. So if you are a postmodernist, you don't bother about that much because it doesn't matter to you. What you're looking at is what motivated people. How did they survive and how did they live? And it's okay up to a point, but it doesn't answer all the questions. So I'm rather a traditionalist, as it's against a postmodernist, I would say, if you have to put a label on me.
Do you think we're moving into a phase really now of post-postmodernism, in the sense that people are reacting more against that now? And there's certainly a lot of narrative histories back on in the popular realm as well at the moment, I think.
Yes, I think we are, actually. I think people who are not necessarily professional historians, just who like to read about history, they want to know about people. They want individuals. They want heroes, perhaps a bit too much so. And so if you write a biography, then, of course, that's traditional history, in a sense. It's not postmodernist. You can't be a postmodernist and a biographer, I don't think, at the same time. So, in a sense, I think the world is becoming more united in that people who are writing history nowadays they want to know about actions. If you take, for instance, a lot of literature coming out now about 1914, about the origins of World War I, you have some splendid writing on that. Christopher Clark, for instance, is a wonderful historian who talks about the individuals concerned who were taking decisions or not taking decisions, which had immense consequences for humanity and the mistakes that they made. That's something that is very refreshing to see that books like that are coming out.
Well, I think we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you very much for joining us. It's been absolutely fascinating just listening to your take on some of these sort of major issues, particularly this idea about Brezhnev's regime. Thank you very much once again.
Well, thank you very much for listening to me, and all the very best to you. Thank you, and to your students too. All the best.
Well, I've been talking to Professor John Keep about society, politics, and the Soviet economy under Brezhnev. For more information on this topic and for links to Professor Keep's books, be sure to visit our website at andallthat.co.uk/meet-the-historians. For more updates and future programmes, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at @andallthatweb and make sure to subscribe to our podcasts on iTunes or Podomatic. The links to these are on our website. Thank you very much for joining us.